ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Science Show.
I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams. And here's a question. With all our inundation of communication tech, worries about antisocial media, series of discussions on Radio National about brain rot, and of course the restriction of media for the under-16s in Australia, an experiment watched around the world. Yeah, here's the question. Is it surprising that simple experiments, such as asking high school students to write old-fashioned essays, could, yes, be good for them and us? So, Belle, what do you think of the experiment of the Whitlam Institute, University of Western Sydney?
Oh, it's a lovely bit of qualitative research. And I like what you said just now, Robin, about the experiment being good for us too. Too many people assume that teenagers don't think about their future, that they're just preoccupied with whatever's happening right now. But that's not true. So how did you come across the essay competition?
Well, I first heard of it on ABC Sydney Radio, a discussion hosted by Hamish McDonald and featuring the director of the Whitlam Institute, University of Western Sydney, Professor John Durance. Now, the whole point for us on The Science Show now is that question of benefit. The students said that they had a real lift psychologically. And so, this also, by the way, applied to the experiment with tree planting we broadcast on The Science Show recently. Has there been a follow-up test for real evidence of benefit? And what does it mean? Here now is Professor John Durance.
John Durance. I'm a professor here at Western Sydney University, and I'm the director of the Whitlam Institute.
Professor of what?
I come from the law school, so previous to my position here, I was a law professor.
That's interesting. And you're involved with enabling young people to write things. How did this competition start?
This competition started over 20 years ago now, and it started as a format to engage young people in determining what mattered to them, to hear their voices in their own voices. And it started with collaboration between the Whitlam Institute and the Sydney Morning Herald.
And who was invited?
This competition was a national one, so we had a call out to all independent schools and public schools in every state and territory across Australia. At the beginning, it did focus most particularly in the Sydney area. In the years hence, we've been able to grow it into a national competition. And if I can say now, in this year, we've had over 6,500 submissions, and it is now the largest writing competition for young people in Australia.
How much do they have to write?
The rules are very, very simple. So we have up to 600 words in poetry or prose on any topic of their choosing, as long as they answer the one question, what matters? That's it.
Do many of them write about science?
Not directly. When you ask a young person what matters to them, they become instantly reflective. They think about their personal circumstances, their personal environments, and they become quite serious about that. They think about their families, they think about circumstances in life, wealth or poverty, their health or lack of health. They talk about cultural identity, their sex or sexuality. They talk about their anxieties. They talk about the anxieties of their loved ones, their immediate families. They talk about their immediate circumstances in their social groups, so whether or not they are being bullied or they feel a lack of confidence in an area of their life. And they talk mostly about those things that are pressing on their happiness day to day.
And as for response, do you get more boys or more girls, or is it 50-50?
It's nothing close to 50-50. Overwhelmingly, we get most of our competitors are young women, young girls.
How do you explain that?
It's a phenomenon, I think, that goes right through creative writing. The number of women or girls involved in creative writing far outweigh the young boys and men these days. And for the high school competition, we have reliance, of course, upon the teachers in the classroom. And the teachers in the classroom often incorporate this competition into their curriculum, but it's never compelled, and submissions are voluntary. And we just find that more girls are, I guess, interested in the act of writing than young boys are. So part of our task is to activate young people, particularly boys, to engage more. But of course, we do get thousands of submissions from boys every year now, and we find that they write about things in their personal circumstances in the same way that young girls do.
Now, when it comes to the effect of that experience writing, you've done something of a study. One of your colleagues is a professor of psychology here, I think. What have the findings been?
Well, we have 20 years of this competition, so a very rich and diverse data pack. But her last analysis looked at the results for the last 5 years. And this is probably a consequence of COVID, consequence of social media, and new ways in which young people are able to engage with their peers, with the world. We're finding that the seriousness of the topic matters that had usually been present in the older children are now being engaged with more thoroughly by younger and younger people. So younger people who may have talked about things that were more peculiar to their family life, for example, are now talking about things such as climate change and where they get information from, but also things such as cost of living, housing insecurity, immigration, childcare, energy, women's health. A very strong theme is their personal identity. So things such as their diversity, their ethnic and their linguistic diversity, feeling included and not included, and also about this idea of multiculturalism and First Nations peoples and inclusion and what is an Australian? What are they in Australia? How are they Australian? How do they feel included? How do they feel excluded? Where are those anxiety points? And what it's lovely for me to read as a Canadian who grew up in Canada during Pierre Trudeau and Pierre Trudeau's introduction of the official Canadian policy of multiculturalism, is seeing how multiculturalism in Australia has had an impact. And that's one of the deepest and most significant legacies of the Whitlam era. This year, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Racial Discrimination Act. And that is really Australia's first human rights act. And it was an emphatic statement of identity for Australians. We were no longer a white Australia country. We were a country now going to be defined by our diversity and draw strength from our diversity. And so those people who didn't have a European background could identify equally as Australians and see themselves reflected in the idea of what an Australian looked like and sounded like. And so seeing young people deal with their identity and their inclusion in the Australian society and grappling with that and making insistence that they are Australian and this is who I am and I am an Australian just as anyone else is a powerful thing to watch. Because I think it's part of the civics and citizenship aspect of this competition is these are young people understanding who they are and saying that I am an Australian, this is how I'm going to be included, and this is my worth. And this competition validates that, celebrates that, and admires it in the young people's voices.
With all of that material and 20 years of it, as you say, and the tremendously powerful response you've had, has anyone thinking about how to harness that, how to direct it in some way in education or publication or what?
Yes, I think with the failure of the Voice referendum and with the catastrophic failure of any referendums in this country, the idea of civics and citizenship is something that is universally recognized as something that Australians do exceptionally poorly. But Australians at the same time feel very confident about the robustness of their system. Despite the dismissal of the Whitlam government 50 years ago and the political crisis that inspired that, and the constitutional design that enabled it, despite those problems and those legacies of crisis, our constitution has not been reformed since that time. But I think the overwhelming view of most Australians and young people in particular is that we do have a good system. We're proud of our electoral system. We're proud of preferential voting. We're proud that apportionment is so incredibly low. We're proud that we've got rid of gerrymandering and rural weightage. We're proud that we have advancement of the one vote, one value so energetically and successfully in this country. Yet, young people in particular think that our politicians need to do better. But just because we think that they need to do better doesn't mean that they think our system is beyond repair and is not a highly successful system of government that we can be proud of as a nation.
What about for individuals showing talent through writing, the experience of getting to know their own ideas? Is there any way of harnessing that that's practically being applied at the moment?
Well, I think this competition itself does harness that. So this year we received 6,500 submissions. So we have a large group of educators who read each and every one of those entries, and they take the 6,500 down to shorter lists and they develop the top entrants. And then when it comes to me, I then do a vetting from the long list to a short list, and then we give it to an expert to pick a winner. In that process, we discover that young people are writing extraordinary things, but an extraordinarily diverse topic base, and marvel at their expression. You marvel at it. And I continually think, how is it possible that a 14-year-old wrote this or had this sophistication of thought? And you think, oh, certainly there must have been a parent helping, a teacher helping. And then you meet these young people, and within a few seconds, you realize, this person is extraordinary, utterly special, and this is how they produced it.
Why don't we put them on the radio?
Last few years, we have had the winners come onto the radio. And
the winners are fine, but you see, there's a problem with the gold medal winners. In some ways, as my friend Philip Adams showed, life be in it and exercise. You didn't want to show Olympic champions all the time because people know that, well, I'm not an Olympic champion, so I won't take part. No, it's for norm, yes. The normal person.
I think that's a brilliant idea. And I think there's nothing better than hearing the young people in their own voices without being interpreted or extrapolated by someone else, let alone an adult. I think that's a wonderful idea because that diversity and the authenticity of their voices, children are uncompromising truth tellers, and hearing that from their own voices is utterly transformational. So I think the whole point of this competition is to hear from young people in their voices. So I'd love any opportunity to have both more of these young people express their impact of their works, why they came to produce it, and what their thoughts are in their own voices in an interview setting.
I think 2026 should be the time that we try this. Thank you.
I'm very much looking forward to that. Thank you very much for your time, Robin.
Professor John Durant at the University of Western Sydney, and there will be a national event at the end of June to plan what's next for this huge experiment. And Bell, one aspect I find telling is that these young people think of the future being next year or soonish. The long-term future is for them uncertain. What do you think?
It's interesting, isn't it? I remember being in high school and having only a very vague sense of what my adult life might be like. Now, superimpose that onto a warming world and political instability and the housing crisis, and I can completely understand only wanting to think ahead a couple of years at a time.
Yes, I quite agree. And next week we shall hear from Professor Pip Collin, who's analysed the hundreds of essays to seek evidence of benefit, plus a reminder of those primary school tree planters in Perth. Are they too being lifted by active hope? The Science Show on Radio National. Bill, meanwhile, you've been investigating those huge offshore turbines and the worry that some may interfere with wildlife in the water. What's happening?
Well, this year is a census year in Australia. It's been 5 years since the last one, if you can believe it. But did you know that scientists have been doing their own census off the Chinese coast? They've been looking at communities of plants and animals and other organisms that congregate around wind turbines in the sea. James Tweedley is a marine ecologist from Murdoch University and took part in the research. But first, I wanted to find out just how big these offshore wind turbines are.
They're crazy big, and particularly bigger in the ocean than they are on the land. So on the land, they tend to be closer to humans, and you're limited by getting the wind turbine components to the site. That generally means putting them on a truck. So the blade lengths of land-based or onshore wind farms tend to be about 70 to 80 metres. But you can double that with an offshore wind farm. And so you can be looking at 115 to 130 plus metres. So for context, that's longer than a soccer pitch and about the width of an AFL pitch. just for one of the blades, and then you double that to get the diameter.
Incredibly massive. So why are they so much bigger out in the ocean?
A, they're easier to build at a bigger size there, but also they're less of an eyesore. So you wouldn't necessarily want a wind turbine that big dominating the landscape. On land, you can get away with that with the offshore wind farms because every 12 and a half kilometres you go, you can't see the horizon. So these big structures kind of disappear from the field of view offshore. It's also a harsher environment for the wind turbine to be in. You've got the corrosion from the salt. And so building them bigger makes them more robust. They can require less servicing because servicing costs are high. So if you have a smaller number of larger turbines, you can save on maintenance costs.
So for something that massive out in the ocean, I imagine its foundation would have to be really, really big and strong, or at least really, really stable.
The wind farm that we were looking at in China, so they could get away with what they call a monopile, which is just a bit like a lamppost, just really big. They were 7 meters in diameter and about 120 plus meters long, and they went 11 meters into the sediment. So that gives them a surface area of about 440 square meters, which is about the block size for an average house in Australia.
Plenty of room for things to attach to. So to find out exactly what was attaching to these wind turbines, James and his colleagues checked out a wind farm off the Chinese coast up near North Korea in the Yellow Sea. It comprised 60 of these monopile turbines across 48 square kilometres. And in 2022 and 2023, they sussed out what lived on and around these huge lamppost-like foundations.
So sampling was as simple as putting a probe in the water and seeing how much light there was and how that changed with depth, and collecting plankton in a bottle, to going scuba diving and scraping material from the turbines. We used a grab on a boat and sent that down 30 metres to dig up the sediment. We did some trawling and also some recreational line fishing. And because each of those methods looks at a different part of the community of animals and plants that live in and around the wind turbine area, and we had to sample all of that in order to build the model.
The grab that you mentioned, I keep thinking of one of those claw games that you get in arcades, but one that will actually like scoop up stuff. Is that what that does?
Almost exactly, yeah. So it's like the big claw, but it's got a steel frame around it that sits on the sediment and then the claw comes down.
What did you find?
We work out what's there from the surveys in weight, and we group things into functional groups. We found that there was substantially more of all types of animals apart from soft sediment fauna, things that live on sand, in the wind turbine sites than an adjacent control area. We had things like zooplanktivorous fish. So these are the little fish that often swim along with their mouths open and eat plankton, larval forms of animals. So that was one of them. Then we had a fish-eating fish group, a piscivorous fish. So those are fish that, again, feed higher up in the food chain and they eat other fish. Next, we had a bunch of fish that were particularly important for some reason. Most of these were sought after by commercial fishers or recreational fishers. Then there was a bunch of smaller fish that live in rocks and vertical habitats, like in crevices and things in there. And then we had things like crabs, and then a bunch of animals that live on the pylons themselves. So this is things like echinoderms. So they are starfish, sea urchins, some of the mollusks. Mussels was a really big one. So there were some types of marine snails living on the pylons, and then worms.
Something that may have accelerated this marine colonisation was a nearby aquaculture farm. Eggs from farmed fish and abalone and mussels may have drifted to the pylons to help establish these communities. But really, put anything out in the ocean and you're bound to attract something.
We tend to think of the ocean as a light area, but light really only goes 100 to 200 metres down. Most of the ocean is dark, which is a really weird thing to think about because we wake up in the light. And so coastal areas are very productive, but the open ocean is incredibly nutrient poor and almost like a desert. And so one of the ways that you can improve the productivity of these areas, short of fertilizing them, which was an idea people had in the 70s, sprinkle iron on them to get phytoplankton blooms, you can produce habitat. And so research has shown over the years that oil and gas structures are actually one of the most productive habitats for fish biomass, because they are providing habitat where there is no habitat. And so habitat is the limiting factor. Have you seen the movie Field of Dreams?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's that catchphrase, build it and they will come. It's like that with structure. So in an area where there's limited habitat, adding habitat gives you more life. And that's really what has happened here.
So monopile foundations are, like you said, they can be 7 metres across and they're driven 11 metres into the seabed. How much damage does installing these turbines do to the marine environment in the first place?
I guess any time you dig a hole in the seabed, you're basically going to be stirring up whatever is in the sediment. So there could be nutrients there from dead animals, naturally dead animals. And there could be heavy metals, any toxins that are in the environment. So any kind of sediment resuspension is not great. In the depth that we were in here, 30 meters, there's not a huge amount of things like seagrass and plants that use light to grow. You don't really get those at 30 meters. So the plume of sediment isn't going to go over seagrass and damage it like it would in a shallow environment. So in some cases, yeah, it's better to do it there than in a shallower environment if there are no seagrass beds, but there's still going to be some liberation of whatever is in the sediment.
We hear a lot about collisions between birds and wind turbines on land. Does this happen with offshore wind turbines too? And could all this extra sea life play into it?
There's lots of concerns with wind farms about birds and migratory mammals, and we did not look at either in our survey. So we were just interested in what goes on in the water. There will be some birds that feed on schools of bait fish in the surface waters. We did not measure that. But the fact that there are more zooplanktivorous fish would suggest that there'll be more feeding opportunities for those birds.
Right, okay.
That could also increase the collision rate between wind turbines and birds and lead to mortality of birds as well. So there are some negative impacts of wind turbines around, do they alter the migratory routes of birds and or marine mammals, and do they lead to mortality of those? We didn't investigate that in our study, but those are valid concerns that people have raised about offshore wind farms and onshore wind farms, to be honest.
What's next for you and your colleagues?
As the turbine monopiles mature, the animals and plants on them will change over time. The community will mature and settle on eventually kind of what we call a climax community, a really stable community. So at the time we did this, the wind farm was very new and it wasn't fully in operation yet. So that has happened now. And so future research could be to let's have a look at it operational. And let's compare this. And yeah, the turbine blades will be spinning and the piles would have been down there longer and potentially had a different community. It would be valuable to see 5 years down the track, how has the food web changed? Is it even more productive? Or is there something that we haven't thought about that says that there's a bit of a honeymoon period when the monopiles go in and we have overestimated the benefits in this case of the turbine monopiles to the food web and the fish that live there.
Now, your study was done in China. How applicable is it to Australia?
Generally speaking, you get the same types of functional groups here as you do in China. The water temperature where we were gets below 5 degrees in winter. So it's a bit cooler than we would get here in Perth, but all of those functional groups are the same. The species may be different, but they function the same way. And that's kind of a way we're moving in science. It's like with climate change and species moving around the world, it's hard to know what individual species do. But if we put them into functional groups and say, hey, this is a small mollusk that filter feeds, it generally has the same role in various areas. So in that sense, it works quite well. The trickier thing would be working out the size and scale of an Australian offshore wind farm. the type of environment it's in and the type of the structure. I know in New South Wales, they're having a look at some of the floating offshore wind farms. And so they are in deeper water. And so our study would be less applicable to that because there is some subsurface structure, but it wouldn't be the type that we had looked here.
Murdoch University marine ecologist James Tweedley. You can find that offshore wind farm study in Global Ecology and Conservation. And this is a science show on ABC Radio National. Robin, that wind farm story reminded me of an interview you did last year with Professor John DeBerry from Caltech on how to use natural turbulence flows, as fish do, or geese flying, to make turbines more efficient. Here's a snippet.
We have, for the past decade, been interested in exploring technologies that would show that bigger isn't always better. There had been a trend in the field for a long time to say we need larger and larger wind turbines. And part of that makes sense. You want to be able to collect wind higher up in the sky where the wind speeds are stronger. But that can lead to some of these environmental challenges of the materials required, of the potential impacts, particularly offshore, if you're going to have these large towers anchored on the seafloor. What we found is that we could take analogy from schooling fish. When fish swim in the ocean, they generate choppy water next to themselves. And what they found that in a school, they can take advantage of that choppy water and organize themselves in certain configurations so that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. They're actually more effective swimming in that group than they are by themselves. In the case of wind turbines, one of the challenges we face is that the individual wind turbines create choppy air. The solution has been to spread out those wind turbines as far apart as possible, but then in the offshore context, it means you do have to take over a big part of the seascape in order to have enough wind turbines to generate meaningful power. What we found is that if we use that biology-inspired example of the fish schools, we can actually use smaller wind turbines that interact constructively and put them closer together. So if we are putting them offshore, the idea is we take up less space, we interfere less with fisheries, with flora and fauna in the area, and in some cases, we can actually get more power out of a footprint than you would using the individual very large wind turbines. So this is work that's still ongoing, but promises the opportunity to be more environmentally friendly, even as we're trying to develop green energy.
That's wonderful lateral thinking indeed. Because with large turbines, I was always impressed by the calculation that you do, that circumference, if it's bigger, you get vastly more energy out of the system. And so that's why the temptation is to have several big ones rather than lots of smaller ones. But your experiment, is it going well with the smaller ones?
It is. So far, we've demonstrated on land that you can get up to 10 times more energy out of a plot of land using this approach. And now that becomes because of the aerodynamic interaction, the interaction between the airflows and the turbines, so that the whole is able to perform better than the individuals. You also potentially get benefits in terms of the economics of building these turbines. When they're at this smaller scale, there's a wider range of materials you can use that can handle the forces that are exerted on those structures. And in a mass production environment, you can also get economic benefits because you're building 10,000 of a widget instead of one of that single widget. Right now, the wind turbine blades on those large systems are often manufactured manually. By hand, they're laying up these blades. And so there's naturally going to be some high costs associated with those large turbines. Getting them to their location, especially offshore, is expensive. And then when you want to maintain them, you've got to take a helicopter out to be able to do that sort of maintenance operation. And so there are many reasons why I think there are other approaches that could be competitive. It's still early days for these new technologies. Remember, the wind turbines you see out there today, that design platform has been incrementally improved over around 40 years. And so it'll take some time for these new technologies to catch up, but I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
John DeBerry at Caltech, and I hope to see him again next week. He won the US President's Medal for Science a couple of years ago. That's under President Biden. Now, Bell, returning to those young people needing not just good news from top science, but as Professor John Durance from the Whitlam Institute was saying at the start of this science show, active hope, themselves from being involved in projects like the Miyawaki Forests program we heard about from Murdoch University a couple of weeks ago. It's become world famous with good reason. Here's the story with Gray Copeland, worth hearing once more. And note how it includes research and evidence of kids being given a genuine, lasting lift mentally.
Well, the cool one is that the Miyawaki Forest Program was featured in 97 Paris subway stations as one of two UNESCO Green Citizens programs that featured. The other was on mangrove systems. Out of 150 programs across the world, they picked, which was a big honour, and I was very proud.
Congratulations, Gray. That's superb. And what about coverage of the activity? Much going on in Australia now?
Yes, the Miyawaki Forest Movement has really grown in Australia, which is absolutely fantastic. So as part of the program, we've now planted 22 forests across Perth and surrounds, which is really good. And 17 of those are in schools, which is excellent. So the more kids we can engage in climate action and get their hands dirty, the better.
Outside Perth, where else around Australia?
We've got quite a few in New South Wales. The Groundswell Collector is doing excellent work there. Canberra, of course. There's some going on in Adelaide. I'm planting one next year in Sydney, which is really fun. So lots of action.
Given that there's a problem with housing, do they sometimes say, well, why should we dig that up and have all sorts of trees there growing? Why don't we have houses there? Because the cost of land is such that got to make it pay. Don't you have those real estate difficulties?
Oh, yes. Well, you're probably well aware that Perth is the longest city in the world, over 150 kilometres long, north to south. I know, shocking.
I had no idea.
Absolutely shocking. In fact, there's a really good documentary that's come out called The Longest City, and it's just won some awards. It's a fabulous film. But, of course, that has come at the expense of our Banksia woodland community, which is now recognised as an endangered plant community. And unfortunately, when developers go out in Perth, they tend to bulldoze everything. It's quite shocking. So you see a lunar landscape with these new housing developments. So the idea is to stop that urban sprawl and to infill. That would be the best option. And the brilliant thing about Miyawaki Forest is that if there's any vacant area of land, you know, you can put a small forest in, be it the size of a car parking spot or a couple of hundred square metres. And that land is maybe unused. It's just an empty grassed area, and it can be teeming with life within a few short years.
And still the enthusiasm of the young primary school kids?
Oh, 100%. So what's fantastic is now I now have a PhD student who's looking at the well-being effects of engaging with the program with the school kids. She's doing fabulous work in Los Ceballos. And in fact, this morning we were out at East Butler Primary School interviewing some year 4 and 5 students, seeing how well they are engaged with the program, the well-being outcomes, how connected they are with nature, what they're doing outside of school, and if the program's inspiring them to do extra things that they perhaps wouldn't be doing or discovering extra things that they probably wouldn't be aware of.
Last time we discussed the problems of getting kids out of school, in other words, with permission and insurance and all that sort of thing, so on, what do you do?
Well, the brilliant thing about the forest that we plant in schools is it's all in school grounds, so we don't need any permissions to go on excursions or anything. It's entirely an incursion, which is fabulous. Often the areas we are rehabilitating are grassed areas, and sometimes we do actually find builders' rubble, wire, glass, you name it, underneath that grass. So before the forest goes in, we have to spend quite a few days rectifying those issues and rehabilitating the soil, rejuvenating the life before the kids could get there. And hopefully it's all ready for them to go when they come and do their planting.
I suppose kids have been playing outside in street-type places for generations. Most of them survive.
Well, I certainly survived. I spent most of my childhood outside across the road in a bushland that we had opposite our place, you know, going in there with my sister and my dog. It was fabulous. I wish more kids would do that.
Where have you been this morning?
This morning we were actually at East Butler Primary School where we were doing the forest monitoring with the kids. We had years 2 and 3 and years 4 and 5. Fabulous kids. These are kids that actually don't have any native vegetation on their school grounds, so their forest is now 2.5 years old, and we have amazing eucalypts in there. We have banksias, we have cocky's tongue, yakuljas, which is flowering and producing these incredible seed pods. We have this listed species in there called Dodonea hackettiana, which is a listed species also, so not very common in our native bushland. And it's absolutely bursting with seed pods. So absolutely fabulous. And in one of the schools, in fact, where we have this species as well, we have got these little seedlings popping up all over the forest. So recruitment is happening. So good to see.
And also young people who are hearing all sorts of warnings about the future state of the planet and so on, getting more and more down, thinking, what can I do? They're now doing it. Is that making a difference to their state of mind? You said that someone's actually studying that sort of thing.
So this is what Inez is studying. She's seeing, you know, what impact the forest program will have on students' well-being and children's well-being. And what she's finding, the interviews she's been doing over the last month, is that the children are really engaged with the program and they actually feel like they are making a difference. And some of the kids who are suffering from eco-anxiety actually feel that they're contributing. They love their forests. And for some of the kids who are in year six who are moving on to year seven, they're sad to be leaving their forest behind, but the school said you can come back and visit your forest whenever you want. So these kids can come and see a legacy piece that they've put in. You know, they're helping to restore a natural system and they're really enjoying it. And I think it's helping their mental well-being.
I would have thought practically every school in the country would be keen on this.
Every school should have some form of Miyawaki forest or bush classroom. So I'm working very closely with the Department of Education, Statewide Services. They have the Bush Classroom Initiative and the Two-Way Science Initiative, because our vision is to make sure that a kid has access to some kind of native vegetation, whether it be just a garden bed or a forest or some kind of bush classroom, where they can get in contact with nature, see what was on budja, what was on land before we cleared it, and just enjoy being in the natural world.
Given the name Miyawaki, have the Japanese recognised your work?
Yes. So what was cool last year was there's a first ever international symposium on Miyawaki forest. So I was one of the people who helped organize that. And that was in Yokohama University. And one of the main people organizing was Professor Fujiwara. So she was Professor Miyawaki's foremost and best student. And she's absolutely incredible. She's an absolute powerhouse. And she's inspiring forest makers all around the world. And we had over 150 participants coming into Yokohama from all around the world. All these people creating Miyawaki forests, all sharing their stories, what's been happening, sharing the science. It was so brilliant to meet everyone, because all these people I've been talking with for years, and to actually see them in person was just brilliant. Yeah.
Incidentally, how long does it take to, depending on the state of the ground that you're dealing with, which could be a disused car park or something ghastly with all sorts of shit there and God knows what else, how long does it take to recover it to bring in the compost and such like, so as the trees have got a good ground on which to grow?
So what we do is at the start of the school year, we get the kids involved in creating their own compost system. So this is really important because it teaches the kids about recycling their waste, making sure their food waste and things doesn't go into landfill. But importantly, it's part of the process of building their forest from the ground up. So we work together to create the compost over about 4 months. So I go back every week and work with the kids, you know, turning their compost, putting more stuff in, taking measurements, seeing, you know, what temperature it's at, you know, what animals are using it. So the kids can see that their waste scraps that would go into landfill are being used to develop their forest. And then basically all that goes into the forest soil before we plant, along with a whole bunch of other things like compost tea, and now using biochar as well. That rejuvenates the soil so that we can create optimal conditions for the plants to grow. And then over the next few years, the forest itself breathes more life into that soil. So hopefully by year three, when the forest is, you know, self-sustaining, with all the leaf litter that's falling, it contributes all kinds of nutrients, and, you know, all the animals you see teeming in the soil. It's just, so it's a relatively short period of time before we can rejuvenate the soil.
And are other nations following suit?
Yes, one of the things we're doing now is actually what I'm calling the Sister Forest Program, where we're linking children who are engaged in the program in Australia with different countries that are planting Miyawaki forests in schools as well. So one of the schools in Perth is now in the process of writing letters to a school in Tokyo, Montessori school there. So they're going to exchange letters talking about their forest, what they're seeing in their forest, pictures, poems, whatever they feel they want to contribute. And the students in Tokyo will send letters back to them, and then they'll have have a video meetup where they can talk to each other through an interpreter. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. And one of the things the Tokyo kids are going to do is they're going to take the kids in Australia on a video journey with them when they go and harvest seaweed along the coastline that they're going to bring back to use as mulch for their forest. So Australian kids will travel with them virtually while they go and harvest this seaweed. It's going to be so amazing.
Congratulations. Thank you, Gray.
My pleasure. Always lovely to talk to you.
Research fellow Gray Coupland at Murdoch University in Perth, lifting young spirits with science all over the world. More on those young people, writing what matters to them in next week's Science Show.
Robin, earlier you mentioned something that's affecting under-16s today, the social media ban. Australia's 3 months into it now, and it aims to protect young people from online threats. But one unintended consequence is it might affect how much they know about democracy and political systems. And the social media ban comes at a time when students' political knowledge is quite low, with just 28% of Year 10s achieving a reasonable level of proficiency in the topic. That's according to a 2024 report. Dr. Zare Garzarian from Monash University has been looking into this. Do you remember when you first got interested in politics?
It was many years ago. It was, funnily enough, before the 1993 federal election. It was the election that people had expected to lead to a change in government. I was in Year 8 at the time. And it was the election that Paul Keating was expected to lose, and he ended up winning. And I remember in the lead up to that being very interested, very enthusiastic about following politics, Australian politics, and seeing what this was all about. And it was ultimately, in the end, an election that proved the polls wrong.
So Paul Keating was the one that inspired an early teenager year to follow this career into political science.
I think he may have played a role, yes. And trying to understand this system that is very complex. It's a very complicated system. We are very different to other systems around the world. So it was an opportunity for me to learn to be better informed about what was going on around me and to engage in those discussions. I'm not sure how many of my peers I enamoured with those discussions, but it was something that I found really critically interesting.
Where did you get your political education from?
A lot of it was independent work that I did. So reading the commentary, reading things like commentators in the Bulletin, for example. I think Laurie Oakes had a regular column there. Reading in The Age, people like Michelle Grattan. I think in that period in the 1990s, especially as I was in high school, that was where I was getting a lot of my information from. And obviously the news services, we didn't have smart devices back then. We were limited to traditional newspaper, talkback radio, and of course the nightly news bulletins. But that was primarily where I drew a lot of my information from.
So that was the 90s. What is the current state of political education for students in Australia?
I think it's significantly different. Obviously, taking aside the technology, which is so very different, so much more advanced now than it was back then. But there are, and there has been, real effort by governments, successive governments, both national and state governments, to introduce civics and citizenship as a formal and important part of the curriculum. And funnily enough, we mentioned Keating earlier. Paul Keating was one of those early leaders, prime ministers, who in the 1990s was motivated to enhance political knowledge. It's something that then John Howard took on during his prime ministership. And since then, we've seen governments invest resources to help young people build their political knowledge, to build their political understanding. And it's not just about winning trivia nights in quizzes, of course. This is about empowering young people to be active and engaged citizens, but also people who are aware of the powers that they have as citizens, so their responsibilities as well as the privileges they enjoy. So it's about ensuring young people as members of a community can, if they choose to, really lead positive change.
And you've been researching this. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I've been working with colleagues researching civics and citizenship education, the development of political knowledge, for a number of years now. And we've looked at the Australian case and we continually find patterns that are emerging. On the one hand, at the national level of testing, we see that there has been a decline in the percentage of young people, especially Year 10 students, reaching the expected level of knowledge for their year level. At the last measure, at the last test, we have just 28% of young people, Year 10 students, achieving the expected level of knowledge. That is the lowest rate on record. And that's deeply troubling because unless young people go on to study legal studies or politics in Year 11 and 12, that may be the end of their development of political knowledge. And of course, young people can then go on to further studies, but for those who leave high school, they may be leaving with a very limited understanding of not just their political world, but also the powers that they have as people in a political system.
What is the expected level for a Year 10? I'm interested as to whether I would actually meet that level.
There are some quizzes online, obviously. There is a whole range of things that the curriculum covers. That includes ideas about democracy, how laws are made. It's pretty wide and it's pretty broad. And even within jurisdictions, we see variations between how it is taught and when it's taught.
Have you spoken to students about what they find interesting about politics?
In the past, we have, but that was before COVID. So we did speak to school leavers, first-year university students before COVID, and they were interested about politics. And we know that young people are always interested about politics. When we have a look at what's going on around the world, we can see young people being active, engaged in political debates, in political campaigns. That's not new. But when we ask them about their political knowledge and how they have developed it, there were these real gaps that we saw. We had participants, for example, unsure that there were different levels of government in Australia, and others were a bit confused about how the system worked, as well as their rights and responsibilities. So it is a big area for challenge. And we've also, of course, spoken with teachers as well. Part of my E.G. Whitlam Institute fellowship, one of the things that I've been looking at is how teachers teach civics and citizenship. And they have also talked about how they've had limited opportunities to build their support networks through participating in professional learning opportunities, for example.
What does that mean? Can you give me an example of that?
Other sorts of subjects may have professional development for teachers to upskill, to potentially introduce them to new learning methods or learning resources. Whereas in civics and citizenship, the teachers that I spoke to at least had limited opportunities to do so. Many of them were talking about not being familiar or even remembering opportunities that may have come up. So they may be there, but the teachers that I spoke to, at least many of them, it was something that they weren't clear about.
So students' knowledge is dropping. Why is that?
There's more information that's available out there. The rise of smart devices are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Virtually everyone is now connected online. So you would think that there's this great amount of information out there. What my research has been looking at is potentially, are there ways to support teachers in teaching and delivering the content? And that may be where we can find an opportunity to help support teachers. Teachers, of course, have a massive load on. They've got to teach so many things in such a limited amount of time. We can see that there are those opportunities for helping teachers, just providing them, whether it's additional resources, whether it's additional support in terms of learning practice, teaching practice, whatever it may be, that may be a way to try and support what's going on.
And the recent social media ban, how do you think that will affect what students know about the political systems around them?
It's interesting. So, yes, part of the project that I've been working on and speaking to teachers, many of them did say that they had the students looking at and getting information from social media about politics, about government, about things that are going on in the world. Without access to that information, I'd be concerned about how young people can then develop their political knowledge without having access to that information. And yes, we understand the potential benefits of the social media ban and why it was in place, But an unintended consequence may be this impact on how young people develop their political understanding, develop their capacity to engage with their political world.
Is it time to bring back the hard copy newspapers and get kids listening to talk back like you did in the 90s?
They're still there. There's no limit of that. Of course, the beauty of social media is the instant nature of how information travels. And that is both a good thing and a bad thing. It is a good thing in that young people can be part of the world immediately and engage in debates immediately. One of the challenges is that it can lead to the infiltration of disinformation, misinformation. And I think that's why it's really important why people have that knowledge, because they then can see through misinformation, disinformation, and call out things that are just not true or designed to manipulate immediately when they see them.
Dr. Zare Garzarian, a political scientist at Monash University. Last year, he was awarded an E.G. Whitlam Research Fellowship from the Whitlam Institute, which is headed by John Durrants. Finally, how much do you know about the Space Shuttle Challenger? 40 years ago, it took off from Cape Canaveral in Florida, but just 73 seconds later, it disintegrated, killing all seven crew on board. Fiona Pepper has been looking into the disaster for a science fiction series called The Challenger Legacy. Now, Fee, I'd just learnt how to walk when the Challenger disaster happened, so I have zero memory of it, and I know that you're much the same. What got you interested in the tragedy now?
Yeah, I was 6 months old when Challenger happened, so yeah, I don't have any memory either. But about 6 months ago, I came across the term normalization of deviance. And I discovered that its origins lie with the Challenger disaster. And this sociologist named Diane Vaughan came up with the term after the investigation into Challenger. And basically, it's a term used to describe the slow erosion of safety protocols within organisations, not just within NASA. It's sort of applicable to organisations across industries. For a lot of people, that term really resonated after Challenger and also after the Columbia disaster in 2003. But it's by no means the sort of definitive cause of the Challenger disaster. That's just sort of one sociologist's theory. What's incredible about this tragedy is it's equal parts a mechanical failure, but also a cultural failure in terms of what was going on within NASA. And there have been a bunch of sociologists who have really tried to get to the bottom of what was going on culturally within NASA to have led to that disaster and disasters that followed it.
To get an idea of that culture, who were some of the people you spoke to for the series?
So the key people we spoke to were engineers who were working on the space shuttle. And Morton Thiokol was this Utah-based engineering company that was building the solid rocket boosters. So these solid rocket boosters are on the edge of the space shuttle and they get the space shuttle into orbit. Basically, you know, they're described as like a big bomb. But because the solid rocket boosters are a few stories high, they can't be built in one segment. They have to be built in sort of several segments and then joined together. So where those joins are, they need to seal really, really well because they're full of fuel. And so there's these rubber O-rings that sit within these joints. For the duration of the space shuttle program, since STS-2 in 1981, these engineers had seen corrosion of these O-rings, which you shouldn't see on an O-ring. And they actually were really alarmed after a launch in January 1985 when they saw the most damage that they'd seen on these O-rings. And that was when they came up with this theory that cold temperatures were exacerbating the performance of these O-rings. And they were right.
The Challenger Legacy is a five-part series of science fiction hosted by Fiona Pepper and Dr. Carl. You can hear it on ABC Listen or catch it on Radio National on Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. Next week on The Science Show, alongside what matters to thousands of young Australians, meet the bloke in charge of Australia's oldest scientific institution and discover a cave where our Homo sapiens ancestors may have come across an unknown species of human. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Belinda Smith. The Science Show can be heard in full on Saturdays at noon and Monday at 4 a.m. Our short version is Monday at 1:30 p.m. and Tuesday, 9:30pm, with the full version and individual stories available on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.